It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, Wisconsin often gets compared to Minnesota when it comes to the economy. But the differences may have a lot to do with one factor, the Twin Cities. We'll hear about a new report from the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance.
First, President Obama delivered his final State of the Union address last night. Avoiding the usual list of new proposals, Obama opted to talk about national trends and about his broad view for the future.
He began the speech by addressing the deep divisions that stand between the parties, went on to admit a regret of his time in office.
I have no doubt a president with the gifts of Lincoln or Roosevelt might have better bridged the divide. And I guarantee I'll keep trying to be better so long as I hold this office. But my fellow Americans, this cannot be my task or any president's alone.
Now, despite that partisan divide, the president urged cooperation and spent a lot of his speech addressing anti-immigrant rhetoric and recent concerns over national security. Here with us now to talk about both the State of the Union and Governor Nikki Haley's response is USA Today Washington correspondent Paul Singer. Paul, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back. Nice to be with you.
Well, Paul, was it a surprise to you that the president sort of broke format on this, didn't do a laundry list of proposals, and instead sort of went big picture and talked about what he'd done and the big picture issues of his presidency?
Well, you know, we had a warning from the White House that was going to be the approach this time. I mean, I think they recognize that there's not a lot of lists of things they can ask Congress to do at this point. A Republican Congress going into a presidential election year is not likely to just sort of take up and pass a bunch of new initiatives the president, the Democratic president, is offering. I think what surprised us most is how political the speech turned out to be. I mean, he really directly rebutted a whole bunch of the campaign rhetoric of the Republican front runners, both Donald Trump and Ted Cruz to a lesser degree, and really said, you know, don't believe what Republicans are telling you on the campaign trail about the troubles America faces.
He talked in general terms about the Republicans, but not in specific so much as attacking candidates. What do you make of his approach with that?
Right. Well, it was pretty thinly veiled, but, you know, he didn't name anybody. But when he says, you know, we can't, you know, attack people for being Muslim, well, you know, that's clearly a reflection of Donald Trump's comment that we should, you know, bar Muslims from coming to the United States. When he says, you know, it's ridiculous to say that we're just going to carpet bomb ISIS, well, that was a direct quote from Ted Cruz. So, you know, he was clearly, yeah, he wasn't using anybody's name, but I think everybody in the room knew who he was talking about.
And how did that go over? What are the next day ripples from the Republican Party there and from Democrats on the political nature of that stuff?
Well, I mean, the Democrats, I think, agree. They say, you know, Obama, again, this goes back to the sort of the true division we're facing. You know, they say Obama made the case that we need to, you know, bring everyone together and play nicer and not be sort of giving in to our fears. And the Republicans say that Obama took what is supposed to be a presidential address to the Congress and turned it into a political diatribe. And so, you know, what you heard depends largely on where you sat, to the right or to the left.
Right, and it's an interesting thing because on the one hand, you hear those political overtones, pretty direct overtones at times, directed at the Republican camp. On the other hand, he's saying the thing I feel worst about my entire two terms is that I didn't do more to bring people together. I mean, after all, this is the guy who ran on hope and change and bridging that divide. And there was not a whole lot of bridging that went on during his almost 8 years. But he did talk about it. He felt bad about it last night. At least that's what he said.
We were kind of yucking that up last night. This is, you know, his speech was essentially, you guys are all wrong and you're jerks, but let us come together and reason together, you know. And you know, interestingly, this morning I was talking to Nancy Pelosi at her weekly press conference, and I asked her, you know, don't Democrats have some responsibility for this? You know, Obama's talking about the polarization and how he feels bad that he hasn't done more to reach through that and fix the polarization. Isn't some of that the Democrats' fault, too? And she looked at me like I had three heads and said, no. It's, you know, as soon as he was elected, the Republicans said, and this is a reference to an old Mitch McConnell comment, that, you know, his primary goal is to make sure that Obama's a one-term president. And that was the Republican agenda, and there's no way we could work with them. It's like, well, okay then. So it's all the Republicans' fault. And that's really how they view it.
He said last night, I mean, it was an effort at humility, no matter how you read that. He said, if I were a Lincoln or a Roosevelt, maybe I would have done better. What do you think about a line like that? Is it genuine?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, again, they ruled in different times, Lincoln and Roosevelt. You know, it was bringing a country through a true crisis. At the moment, you know, one of the interesting things about Obama's time is that this is a time of great upheaval in some ways, but the country is not at the moment in a kind of incredible crisis. In fact, the incredible crisis might have been 2007, 2008, 2009, and Obama actually did manage to get the Congress to agree to a, you know, what was it, $800 billion stimulus package. So there are times when leadership has been possible, and even bipartisan agreement has been possible. For that matter, Obama even recognized that in his speech last night that Speaker Paul Ryan was able to work with the president at the end of the year last year to avoid a government shutdown and to get a spending bill passed and some tax extensions passed. So it's not that they can't do anything. It's just that their ability to agree on stuff is extraordinarily prescribed, and it really only happens when we're staring at the bottom of a cliff.
Right, and he did, as you said, mention working together with Paul Ryan. Also said, well, maybe that could happen again in the future. There was some optimism there, and that seemed to be the tone that he was going for. You heard a lot of politicism, but a lot of people also heard optimism there, saying, yeah, you know, here we are going out my last term, and things are looking pretty good. And people said, hey, even Michelle Obama was wearing a marigold or a mango-colored dress to express hope and optimism. Did you get that when you watched this?
Yeah, well, I mean, it was very clear that part of this speech was what I would consider the basis of what Obama's going to be saying on the campaign trail over the next 6 months for whoever the Democratic candidate for president is. It was essentially, don't believe the argument that the country is going down the toilet. You know, Obama was saying, basically, look, the economy is better than people are telling you. We're not in a World War III. We are not existentially threatened by ISIS. The country is actually in pretty good shape, is what he was saying, and we should take pride in that, and we should, you know, not let our fears guide us. And I think the second half of that is not let people who are running for president preying upon our fears guide us.
We're digesting last night's State of the Union address with USA Today's Paul Singer. And here's a little bit from last night. This is President Obama sounding an optimistic note, calling for cooperation.
Opportunity and security for our families, a rising standard of living, a sustainable, peaceful planet for our kids. All that is within our reach. But it will only happen if we work together.
That sounds a bit like the 2008 Obama, a little bit echoing that hope and change that he ran on. What did you hear there, Paul?
Right. And you know, there are some things where there is potential agreement with Republicans. It's not, I don't think, as broad as it would sound in those comments. I mean, I do know that you know, Obama is very interested, and in fact, the Obama administration has said several times they're interested in working with Republicans on some sentencing reform issues, some criminal justice issues. I mean, I think there's pretty broad agreement that there's more that we can do there. There's more the nation can do on, you know, sort of smart policing techniques, stuff like that. In a fairly narrow a list of issues, but there are real issues. One of the things that Speaker Ryan would love to be able to do is to tackle kind of a broader overhaul of the tax system. That, while I think President Obama would agree is a good idea, I doubt they'd be able to come to a broad agreement on principles, particularly in an election year. So, yeah, there is definitely an opportunity to move forward on some relatively small projects. The problem is, you know, it's an election year, as I said, so nobody wants to hand a win to the other side.
And as you said, there was some rosy views of the economy there, a major feature of his presidency, dealing with the flagging economy. And he also talked about income inequality that's been a big feature of the Democratic contender's rhetoric. Here's a clip from last night.
After years now of record corporate profits, working families won't get more opportunity or bigger paychecks just by letting big banks or big oil or hedge funds make their own rules at everybody else's expense.
And Paul, obviously Bernie Sanders has been beating that drum for a long time now. How does it sound coming out of the president's mouth?
Well, it's not at all surprising to hear coming out of Obama's mouth, because the president, he has basically been making this case, and I think the whole Democratic Party is going to be making this case all year long, that it is an economic inequality issue that is the primary concern, and I think the president was also saying that it is those economic inequalities that are creating the fears that the Republican candidates are preying upon. But this is, again, a direct contradiction to what the Republicans would describe as the problem in the country. They would say the problem is not too little regulation, but too much.
We're talking right now to USA Today Washington correspondent Paul Singer. We're digesting President Obama's final State of the Union address last night.
And you can help out at 800-642-1234. What did you make of his speech? Do you think the president is right that there's fear-mongering going on? Do you agree with his optimistic view of America's present and future? Do you think he responded adequately to concerns about national security and the economy? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation with USA Today Washington correspondent Paul Singer, looking at President Obama's final State of the Union address.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. First of all, did you watch this thing? The viewership was projected to be pretty low. And if you did watch it, what did you make of the speech? Did you watch Governor Nikki Haley's response? And what do you think of her message for her own party? A little bit of controversy there. You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Paul, what about the viewership last night? Do we know how many people watched?
You know, I have actually not seen a report on that, honestly. But one way or the other, it is still going to be the biggest audience President Obama is going to have, probably, you know, towards the end of his presidency. I mean, he doesn't have many of these opportunities to address the whole nation at once. So even if it was not high from a television standpoint, it's a pretty big audience for the president and a pretty big deal for the president to be able to deliver his message to the whole country at once.
And this was the first State of the Union for Paul Ryan of Wisconsin to be sitting over the president's shoulder. I don't know how much there is to talk about there, but there was talk about him on Twitter. Did you have any thoughts, having watched a lot of these things, about what it was like seeing him there?
We actually have an interview with him today. My colleague Susan Page sat down and interviewed him today, and I don't think I'm yet at liberty to disclose everything he said, but we posted a little piece of it where he said it's kind of a challenge to sit there with a straight face, poker face the entire time. He says, I was trying to just blend into the wallpaper, you know, and whenever the president would say something about his numbers, I would run the numbers in my head and think to myself, I think that's wrong, but he wouldn't say anything. And so the challenge for him, he said, it was exactly as you're saying, the first time through, is to try to sit there and disappear while Twitter goes wild with his built-in smirk.
And it's got to be a tough job. Well, there was a Republican response last night, not by Paul Ryan, of course, but by South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley. And she has been a choice pick. People are kicking her name around for vice president. Was this a test for her, maybe?
Maybe. You know, we joke a lot about the sort of toxic stain of giving the State of the Union response, because so many of those people have been seen as rising stars in either party and then have gone on to basically disappear into irrelevance. But nevertheless, Haley gave what was considered by a lot of people to be a pretty good speech, pretty good appearance, pretty good presentation. But today, a vocal group of conservatives have responded very negatively, saying that that her speech was really not truly conservative enough and didn't really reflect conservative values, and was being critical of particularly Donald Trump.
Right. Some people said that she came out of the gates a bit critical of her own party. Here's a little bit of what she had to say.
We as Republicans need to own that truth. We need to recognize our contributions to the erosion of the public trust in America's leadership. We need to accept that we've played a role in how and why our government is broken.
So she came out today and said, you know, she was trying to speak the truth, tell some of the hard truths. Do you think that that cost her that little bit there among her own party?
It might. I mean, there's also, she said, it's not only the sort of admitting that we're part of the responsible, the problem, I think. She also said that we can't give in to the angriest voices in our own party. And then went on to say, you know, immigrants should be allowed to come here if they plan to work hard and love our country and commit to our way of life.
So is that again, a Donald Trump, a veiled Donald Trump reference?
It's possible. You know, it's hard to tell. Depends on where you sit. But we've been talking to people today in the halls of Congress, particularly some of the conservatives, who were very unhappy and just felt like, you know, this was a poke at other conservatives and not an appropriate thing, and essentially that Nikki Haley is not conservative enough. And when was the last time we had a real, true conservative stand up and give the State of the Union a response? And, of course, we then said, well, what about Michelle Bachmann? She gave the State of the Union response. And they're, oh, yeah, but that wasn't the real response. That was the Tea Party response, not the official one.
Right. So what does it take to make it the real response?
Yeah, I don't know. Well, I mean, it has to be, you know, the Republicans have to give 5 minutes of national airtime to somebody who believes the most conservative or agrees with the most conservative wing of their party. And I don't think they're willing to do it.
And so coming out of this, as you said, this is one of the last major platforms that the president is going to have until the next election. What does this mean for him going out here? The Congress obviously not going to be cooperative at this point. So what lies ahead for President Obama?
Well, I think a lot of what lies ahead for Obama is trying to tell the story of his successes, his administration's successes, and the nation's successes over the past 8 years, in part because he wants to protect his and preserve his legacy, and in part because he wants to remind people that a Democratic president did good so that he can help elect the next Democratic president. I mean, the thing that's going to matter most to President Obama is to elect a Democratic president who will sustain things like Obamacare. Because if there's a Republican president, some of the things that President Obama considers his greatest achievements will go out the window very, very quickly. And I think that has to be very, very high in his agenda over the next 6 months or so.
Let's take a caller now. We've got Ben with us in La Crosse. Ben, hi.
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to make what I feel is an adjustment or a correction, if that's the right word, to your correspondent's comment about the inability to achieve anything in the government is equally the fault of the Democrats and the Republicans. I think that fails to recognize the historic shift over the last decade or so of the Republican Party to the extreme right wing. Many of the people that are in office now in the Congress have replaced more moderate Republicans with really ideologues who are refusing to pass any legislation whatsoever if it in any way compromises with the Democrats.
All right, Ben, thanks for your call. Paul, what do you think?
Well, you know, that's pretty much what Nancy Pelosi was saying to us this morning, is that the reason Congress can't achieve anything is because there is a significant group of lawmakers in the Republican Party who are unwilling to compromise on anything. And maybe that is correct. I will say that, they have managed to pass spending bills. They have managed to keep government open. They just passed a $622 billion extension package of tax cuts with a significant number of Democratic votes combined with a good number of Republican votes, just not all of them. To some degree, the caller is correct that the challenge has been corralling enough Republican votes to get stuff done. The question is, as the Republicans would say, oh, yeah, but we could get more done if some of the Republicans would play along with as some of the Democrats would play along with us instead of demanding we play on their terms.
Some people saying they were surprised about the things that he didn't talk more about, one of those things being gun issues. There was an empty seat next to Michelle Obama to represent some victims lost to guns. But was there a surprise there?
You know, it was weird. He didn't mention anybody in the box. You know, the first lady's box is usually where they stuff people who are symbolic of various agenda items. So, you know, the military officer who stopped a potential terrorist attack on a European train was in the box. A guy whose partner was killed in the San Bernardino shootings was in the box. The empty chair, as you said, was in the box, again, to talk about gun violence and to symbolize the president's interest in addressing gun violence. And President Obama didn't address any of them. He didn't even call out Michelle Obama, which was weird. What's the point of having them all there if you're not going to give them a chance to stand up and get applause lines?
Well, he was trying to shorten it up a little, I heard last night.
But that's what he said, you know, keep it tight.
And it was. It was the last one for President Obama. Next year, I guess we'll be talking about somebody different. Well, Paul, thanks a lot for joining us and going over this one.
Thanks for having me, Veronica.
That was Paul Singer, USA Today Washington correspondent, joining us to talk about President Obama's final State of the Union address last night.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. When we talk about Wisconsin's economy, we often compare it to Minnesota's economy, their neighboring states with similar population sizes and a number of overlapping industries. And in those comparisons, Wisconsin often comes up short.
That comparison then gets made on a political level, often by Governor Walker's critics who say, hey, Democrats in control of Minnesota, things are doing well. Republicans in control of Wisconsin, they get the blame for the state falling behind.
Our next guest says that comparison is unfair and that the differences between the state's economies date back farther than the past decade and have a lot to do with one factor in particular, the Twin Cities.
Here with us now is Dale Knapp, Research Director at Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance. His recent report is called Two State Economies, One Rare Metro. Dale, welcome back to Central Time.
Glad to be here this afternoon.
Well, Dale, people often point toward Wisconsin and Minnesota as being pretty similar, you know, same ballpark for population, same ethnic makeup, similar histories, things like that. There are some similarities, but you say there are some key differences we shouldn't overlook.
Yeah, but as you mentioned in the intro, you know, there have been all of these comparisons of Wisconsin to Minnesota, and they tend to be very short term. And in a lot of the work that we've done on the state's economy, we know that really this goes back a lot further. And so we decided to dig in a little bit deeper. And, you know, we really looked, you know, back to the early 1900s, really. And what you find is there was Wisconsin was generally outperforming Minnesota until the mid-1960s. And there was a shift at that time. And so this lag of Wisconsin lagging Minnesota, you know, is not the last 4 years, the last 10 years. You know, it dates back to the mid-60s. And there's a couple of factors. There's a lot of factors that go into it, but a couple that we identified that were really important. And they're kind of related as well. But one is industry mix. If you look at the most important industries in the two states in the mid-1960s, Minnesota was, and it wasn't necessarily on purpose, but they were better prepared to deal with the economies of the 80s and 90s than we were. Eight of our top 10 industries were in manufacturing. And it continues to be an important industry for us, but we know that manufacturing employment over the past 30 years has lagged. And so as manufacturing has lagged, job growth has lagged here in Wisconsin.
So Wisconsin, I want to jump in, Dale, has followed kind of what you'd call the Rust Belt pattern, I guess, where big manufacturing industries that were key to our state and a lot of the Midwest and Western Pennsylvania, Western New York, other places like that, went into a decline. We were part of that bigger story in Wisconsin.
We were part of that. And if you look at the impact, for example, of the big 1980s recession, we were much more impacted than Minnesota was. And it had to do with the kinds of manufacturing that we had and our reliance on it. You know, if you looked at Minnesota's key industries at the time, only 5 of 10 were in manufacturing, you know, and one of theirs was health services, which we know as we moved through the 80s and 90s became very important. And one of their manufacturing industries, key manufacturing industries, was one that actually defied all of the other manufacturing. It was in instruments, and the computer boom really benefited that industry. So they were by accident or whatever, they were better set up to deal with the economies moving forward. But as you mentioned, the other thing that's often forgotten is the impact of Minneapolis on Minnesota's economy, and really the unusual growth that it's seen. We looked at job growth of the 30 largest metro areas, and to be clear, this isn't just the city of Minneapolis. We're talking about the metro area, mm-hmm. as we would talk about Metro Milwaukee, which includes, you know, Waukesha County, Ozaukee County, Washington County, et cetera. You look at the top 30 largest metro areas, 1969 to 2013 job growth. Minneapolis grew the ninth fastest, which, when you look at the top growers, they're generally in the South, Houston and Dallas and Atlanta and Miami, San Diego. So they really, for a northern city, their growth was very unusual.
We're talking to Dale Knapp right now with Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance. He's telling us a tale of two states, Wisconsin and Minnesota, why their economies diverged about, 30, 40 years ago. And we're getting into the role now that the Twin Cities, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and their region play in that story. So, Dale, you were just saying, Minneapolis, the greater region, growing while other cities in our region were declining in economies. What was it about the Twin Cities that made it different than its peers in the Midwest and in the northern U.S. in general?
Well, it's sort of uniquely located in that it's not right next to Chicago, for example, that we are. And so it's sort of the gateway to the West to some degree. It was large enough to attract a lot of industry, and in particular corporate headquarters. It became a very attractive city for many corporate headquarters. The other thing that Minneapolis had that, for example, the metro that Wisconsin doesn't have, Metro Milwaukee doesn't have, all in one metro area, they have the bulk of their industry. They have state government, and they have their big research university. So all in one metro area, all playing off of each other to some degree. And I think that was a big advantage where, our big metro area, big source of the industry is Metro Milwaukee. And, 90 miles away, we have Madison, the state capital, and the University of Wisconsin. So I think they were able to take advantage of that, of having all of those in one metro area.
And in your report, you say that Twin Cities plays this really outsized role. When we're talking about Minnesota's economy, in many ways, we're talking about the Twin Cities region and how it drives that economy, and there's not a comparable place cluster here in Wisconsin.
Yeah, when people think about Wisconsin, what's the driver? We always think of the Metro Milwaukee area, southeastern Wisconsin, and it has been historically the big driver of industry. But it's only about a third of the state's economy. Our economy is very spread out. We have the La Crosse and the Eau Claire and the Green Bay areas, etc. 70% of jobs are located in the Metro Minneapolis area. So as Minneapolis goes, really so goes Minnesota. And we talked about the outside growth of Minneapolis. That's really driving the state. If you look at the rest of the state, growth is very mediocre.
We've talked to guests in the past who say Milwaukee, over the years, hasn't gotten enough love from the state government, whether Republicans or Democrats are in charge. I mean, I know you don't necessarily prescribe a lot in this report, but is that one thought that we should be trying, putting a priority on developing Milwaukee in hopes of driving the state's job picture in general?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, priority, I'm not sure how it should be a priority, as opposed to other areas. But I do think that we have to figure out a way to get the metro area's economy going again. We've done a number of studies over the past 5 or 7 years on Wisconsin's economy, and the one thing that consistently shows up is that the metro Milwaukee area, the southeastern Wisconsin area, has really been lagging, you know, in job growth, in population growth, in all of those measures. And because it is such a big part of the state's economy, we do have to find a way to get it back on track and get that area booming again. Because if we can get that part of the state booming, the rest of the state will move along with it.
Is there some way to say conceptually, maybe practically, okay, we've got a triangle of Madison, Milwaukee, and Green Bay, and throw the Fox Cities. There are three most populated cities, and to try to make that one economic region, or is the geography too big? Is that too wide an area to make a functional area like the Twin Cities region is?
I think it's too big of an area. You know, essentially, the way to think about this is the Minneapolis metro area is like a mall. And so you have all of these various industries, stores, in one area, taking advantage of all of the traffic that comes through there, sharing costs, sharing a very skilled labor force. Wisconsin is more like a city with retailers here and there and all over the place, and so they don't get to take advantage of a lot of that nearness that Minneapolis provides. So, you know, it's difficult to share costs and share those kinds of things, workforce, et cetera, when you're 90 minutes, 2 hours away. So I think that is a real challenge.
We're talking to Dale Knapp, Research Director at the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance. His new report suggests that the economic differences between Wisconsin and Minnesota have more to do with the concentration of government and industry in the Twin Cities than the partisan makeup of state governments on either side of the border.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Does that ring true to you? Do you think Wisconsin should focus on building up one urban area? What do you think would help make Wisconsin more competitive with Minnesota? Call 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation now with Dale Knapp, Research Director at the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance. His new report suggests that the economic differences between Wisconsin and Minnesota have more to do with the concentration of government and industry in the Twin Cities than they do with the current state governments and their partisan makeup.
We'd like to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. Do you agree with that? Does that ring true? Do you think Wisconsin should try to somehow recreate what's going on across the border there? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now. We've got Robert on the line in Green Bay. Robert, hi.
Hi. My question is, I've always heard this same situation where, well, yeah, it's because Minneapolis that's the real reason, but there's been other things that our state, they've got more jobs than us. They've taken a more liberal act towards their prisons and a lot of, you know, used education more and saved millions of dollars doing that. They're trying light rail. We're getting rid of light rail. You know, and if they're doing something that's not, and saying, well, we're just stuck on the Rust Belt, I thought we were open for business and we were supposed to have a development group that were going to bring jobs in here that turned out they were wasting money. If you have a car you're building and someone comes up with a minivan, then you make a minivan. You don't make up excuses. Then promote those same kinds of businesses they have and bring them in. Don't say, well, we're stuck in a rust belt. And, you know, numbers don't lie. People do, and the numbers are beating us. That's my point.
Robert, thanks a lot for the call. So, I mean, does policy matter, Dale? He's saying, hey, investment in future education over there. They're intentionally working with new industries, new kinds of infrastructure. We're not. That's paying off for them now and will in the future. Is there a case there, Dale?
Well, I do think, one, you know, there is a role clearly for government in terms of education and infrastructure. And yes, we do need to make sure that, you know, those are kept as we invest what we can into those. I do think when you look at investing in economic development, one of the things that we can look to our state and look at one of the big successes is one of the big reasons for the growth in the Dane County area, for example, is the growth of a company called Epic, Epic Systems, who a rapidly growing healthcare technology company that has created multiple spin-offs, is very attractive for young college-educated individuals, and has really been a boom for this area. And so that example can be, we can think about trying to translate that to the Milwaukee area and think about how do we get those kinds of companies to locate in a metro area like Milwaukee, attract the young college graduates, attract the skilled workers. That would begin to create some sort of a boom for that area. So I think, you know, we can take lessons not only from Minneapolis, but I think we can take lessons from here as well.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go next to Billy in Madison. Billy, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question for your guest is what your guest would think about high-speed rail being used to connect these urban areas in Wisconsin, as opposed to like a corporation like Epic that he said, but using, I mean, if we had a high-speed rail between Milwaukee and Madison, you know, someone living in Milwaukee could conceivably want to work for Epic and stay in Milwaukee.
Billy, thanks a lot for the call. High-speed rail looked like it might happen, didn't end up happening. Dale, is that something that would have, in effect, shortened the distance between those two key players in the state's economy?
I think that there's a lot of questions with that would come with that. In particular, with for example something like high speed rail, yes, it gets you back and forth between Madison and Milwaukee or Madison and Green Bay or wherever you're going. But then you have the issue of once you get to that station, then how are we getting then to Epic or wherever we're going? And so is that feasible? And is it really high speed going, through some of these communities? And so there were definitely issues. It's something that could continue to be explored. It's been successful in some areas, not successful in others. So I think that question is still, an open question.
Billy, thanks for that call. We're talking to Dale Knapp from Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance, looking at the economic comparisons between Wisconsin and Minnesota. Back to our callers with Tony on the line in Madison. Tony, hi.
Hi, how are you? And thanks for the program, you two. Back in 1980, we started building prisons, and we outspent Minnesota 5-1 between early childhood education and education on our prison system. You can pretty much look at our bloated prison system and splitting up our communities with stronger penalties. Those kinds of things have pretty much trashed Wisconsin.
Tony?
And I was in both communities at the time. There's no fudge in the numbers. They were spending their money on early childhood education and integration while we were splitting people up and spending on prisons.
Tony, thanks for the call. So investment in education there, prisons here. Dale, over more than three decades, he's saying, do we see an impact from that?
Well, this is actually something that we studied about 5 or 6 years ago. We looked at, we actually did a study comparing Wisconsin to Minnesota in terms of prisons and how we deal with criminals. And he's right that there were two different paths, and we took one path by building prisons. They took another path with more community sanctions. It's unclear what the total economic impact of that was, in terms of jobs, et cetera. But I think, I think you can say that there was definitely, some sort of impact, in terms of the two states, in how we've dealt with crime. You know, in many ways, Minnesota is held up as a model of how to deal with crime. You know, so again, yeah, we've taken different paths. I think there's a lot of more important reasons as to why the two states have diverged, but that could very well be have had an impact.
Briefly, as we wrap up, Dale, is there a way Wisconsin can capture the Twin Cities magic without, you know, annexing the Twin Cities themselves?
Well, we can't capture that magic because we don't the metro Milwaukee area doesn't have the size. But I think there are things that they're doing that we can emulate and scale down and improve the economy here. But again, we have to remember that our economy is, again, very, as I said at the beginning, very disaggregated. That's not going away. That in and of itself is going to be a drag to some degree on overall growth. And there's really nothing that we can do about that. But we can maximize, sort of what we have.
We'll leave it there. Dale, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right. Glad to be here.
That's Dale Knapp. He's Research Director at the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance, talking about the economic similarities and especially differences between Minnesota and Wisconsin.
Frostquakes have returned to Wisconsin, maybe anyway. People in Dodge County and Columbus and elsewhere reported a loud rumbling last night, sometimes even shaking their houses, all signs of a possible frostquake.
Also known, I found, as a cryoseism. I think that's pronouncing it right. Now, we learned on Central Time last winter, or maybe the year before, it's all been a blur, really. Water saturates the ground, it freezes and then expands, and then if it freezes and expands fast enough, boom! Frostquake, ground shakes, big noise.
But was there really a frostquake? Well, the National Weather Service says maybe that's their answer. Another possible explanation, though, the Wisconsin Air National Guard was doing night exercises, and it could have been a fast-flying jet that was rattling those houses, maybe.
So from what I've seen, people reporting this on Twitter, I don't know. I mean, I'm no expert on jets
or
cryoseisms, but I'm going with frostquake. That's what I would put my Powerball money on.
Well, we talked about this, you remember, a while ago, and I think that if there is a boom involved, then it's more likely to be a frostquake.
Yeah, I don't think those jets go quite that fast in exercises. I could be wrong, though. So let us know, by the way, if you felt or heard the frostquake in your neck of the woods. Post on the Central Time Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.